I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin and how did they end? Let's find out on today's special episode of Fan of History.
Yes, it is a very special episode. That wasn't me or Dan reading that, right? We have a very special guest, but maybe a lot of you guys recognize the voice of Ryan Stitt. He's a famous podcaster. He has the History of Ancient Greece podcast. So welcome, Ryan, and thanks for joining us today. We're actually doing this, right?
Yes, yes, finally. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks. And Ryan's a good guy. He's always been, ever since I got involved, Dan told me, keep in touch with Ryan. He's a great podcaster, and he's always, you know, trying to help other podcasters out, so we appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I came across the podcast a couple years ago. You guys are moving pretty slow, so you haven't you're still in the Iron Age.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to make it much past because we come back from 1000 BC decade at a time. I jumped in at the 680s, and we usually get like 4 episodes out of each decade, so
I think I came across it when I think it was in like the late 800s, a couple years ago. So yeah, I mean, you're not moving quite as slow as the people who actually lived it are moving it. But
right, there you go. Yeah, we're doing better than that. And it's as we get closer, you know, as we get, I guess, closer to the present, it gets harder to more research. There's more stuff. You know, there wasn't that much stuff that was, you know, the 800s and things like that. But once you start hitting these exam figures, we probably can't make it past 500 BC because there'll be so much stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's the iron, as you get closer to the classical period slash the Achaemenid Persian period, it's for the Near East, there's definitely a lot more. I mean, most of what you guys do, as you are well aware, there's only bits and pieces that you can really talk about for the ancient Greeks in the archaic period. But, I mean, there's some stuff that you can extrapolate and kind of pull a narrative about, but a lot of it is just like, you know, conjecture, archaeological material, like later sources. It's much, much harder to put together, say, a whole list of narrative for the archaic period. Whereas on the Near Eastern side, it's a little bit easier. So I'm assuming in the next 100 century or so, you guys are going to be pretty heavily Assyrian, Persian, Near Eastern, with a little bit of Egyptian.
Correct. A lot of Assyrian right now. Yeah. We're right in it before, no spoilers, but we're getting close to something. Our next one will be the 640s, so we're getting there. And we do get in Greece. We get the Olympics every 4 years, so we have records of that. So that's good. We have some fun stories on the Olympics. In the 40s, the Pancrati, I can't pronounce bad, but the
Pancration.
Yes, that will be invented.
Or, you know, I'm not sure how. I always struggle with turning that into an adjective. It's the Pancratiasts or the Pancratiatic sports or something. It's always a struggle to turn it into an adjective if I'm even making it right. But it's basically, I'm sure you discussed this, but it's basically the earliest version of MMA.
Correct, right. Boxing yeah. wasn't enough that they had to fight until just about death. Now they had to be able to poke in the eyes and mm-hmm. wrestle and everything else. So,
yeah, hand-to-hand combat when the phalanx breaks down.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a good segue because, you know, going decade by decade, sometimes we miss the big things in history, you know, the big, what's the word I'm looking for? The big sweep of history type of things, certain
the themes.
Themes, yes. Yeah. You know, when you're going, so topic of our episode today is the relationship with the Greeks and the Near East prior to the Persian invasions. Mm-hmm. Like in my school days, I remember being told, or given the impression at least, that the Persians just found out about the Greeks after the Ionian revolt, and then the mainland Greeks, you know, had aided them, and then the Persians sort of said, well, who are these guys? Let's go teach them a lesson.
I learned some pretty odd things too growing up. A lot of it was like this whole Greek miracle thing where the Greek civilization came out of nowhere, where in fact there was so much continuity between the Near East and the Greeks, and both cultures kind of pushed off of each other and influenced the other culture during the Iron Age. I mean, shoot, it was the Phoenicians and the Greeks. I'm sure you've talked about that. And then the through trade, even as far back as the Mycenaean period, they had connections with the Near East. So there's been a connection there. The Greek soldiers fought as mercenaries in pretty much every major battle in Near Eastern history. They may be mentioned, or you can kind of just assume that they were there. You don't want to assume, but you can kind of speculate that that's the case. And in some cases they were even outright mentioned. We have even Greek sources mentioning that they were. So like, you know, they're involved. So there's no way like that famous story later on when the Spartans and the Athenian ambassadors go to the Persian, Darius. Darius. And they're like, who are these people? You know, you can take that with a grain of salt because they obviously would have known who these people were.
Who said who were these people, the Persians or the Greeks?
The Persians. Who were these people? Like, they would have known who they were. I mean, obviously, the Greeks at that point were like small potatoes, to use that analogy or idiom, compared to a lot of the civilizations that were in the Persian Empire, but they would have known who they were.
Sure. That's the point. And there's not a lot of, we don't have a lot of documentation on it, but there's little nuggets here and there. And then there's archaeology we found, and that I did some research on. It wasn't as, Cambridge Ancient History has a whole chapter on it, but I don't know. I find Cambridge Ancient History hard to follow. I have to read the chapters like four times until I can figure out what they're trying to say. Then you got to dig into the stuff.
Very academic.
Yeah, it just seems like they really know it. They say like they make leaps of assumption, or you know, like mm-hmm. you know these things. You're like, wait, that was interesting. What was about that? And then I have to go look it up.
It's been a while. I don't know if I've ever read those. You did send some links. I looked at a few, but I'm not familiar with their work on this particular subject. I've read a lot of the Oxford handbooks, and they are definitely not. I mean, they're great, but they're definitely not accessible in terms of very easy for people who are coming to the topic for the first time.
Yes, that's what we need, podcasters like you and me, so that we could break it down for the rest of us, right?
Mm-hmm. For
so
sure.
I kind of broke this down like in the chronologically. I guess that's because I'm used to it. You know, like where I started mm-hmm. off. I mean, the Mycenaean Greeks. We know they are part of an interconnected world.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of documentation, but there's this one little story about this where we think that the Hittites called Greece Ahiawa. Are you familiar with mm-hmm. that?
Yeah. I talk about that a little bit. My man, this was so long ago. I guess 2016 when I was back in the Bronze Age on the podcast. I've been doing this for 4.5 years now.
Right.
I think it was episode 7, 6, or 7.
Be back there, I would think.
Yeah. We'll go into this caveat real quick. There is very little in ancient history that you can say is a fact. A lot of it is conjecture and speculation based on circumstantial evidence. And one of them, and everybody has different theories. So when you come across a topic, that also makes it difficult, but it also makes it fascinating, at least in my opinion. You could you'll read so many different theories about something. So like Ahiawa, one scholar may see a connection there, one scholar may not. I'm pretty convinced that there is, and mm-hmm. I've read Eric Klein's 1177 book. I know there are other people who disagree with him, but yeah, it's so don't take it completely as fact. Usually I will in my podcast episodes. I'll give a dissenting opinions and approving opinions, and I'll kind of just be like, I think it might be the former or the latter, and then move on.
Right. Yeah.
At least I do that now.
Way back. I'm sorry. What was that?
I said, at least I do that now.
Oh, right.
Early on in the podcast, I was pretty much just like kind of picking and choosing what I thought was appropriate and just going with it. Now I'm a little bit more like into the
both sides of the story
analysis thing. And talking about and digging deeper.
As long as you don't get into these people think there was an Atlantis and all that. And then that's everybody knows that's what drives me crazy, that kind of stuff.
I mentioned that briefly when it came to Crete, how the earthquake, or I'm sorry, the volcano in Santorini, one of the theories is that
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
May have led to the story of Atlantis, but pretty much most of Atlantis is just an allegory that you see in Plato. And it shouldn't be taken seriously.
No.
But yeah.
No, I know. It's just used
as like a tourist guide for when you go to like Santorini or Crete.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I did go. And then you get to say you were at the lost island of Atlantis.
Yeah. And buy some merchandise.
And go check out the volcano and all the litter in it. you could swim out and see the volcano. When I was there, it was still smoking.
It's still active.
Yeah. It's cool, though. So this Ahiawa story is, kind of like maybe... It's funny because then they're talking about the colony of Miletus, right? And then that's a colony that's always caused getting in trouble. There's always some kind of problem with Miletus. So it seems like
Miletus kind of in the Hittite record, I believe, was like Milawanda, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Could be, yeah.
I'm not, my Hittite is not that great.
Really? Come on. We expect better. Yeah. So that they really think that, though, a lot of scholars do think that the Greeks and the Mycenaeans were part of the whole interconnected world, as far as like, the kings that were in contact with each other, calling each other brother, it was probably a more united Greece, I would think, at the time, right?
Not united like politically, but there was definitely unity in like a cultural unity. You see similar art, similar trade goods in most cities, like they kind of were shaped around the citadels and stuff. They kind of, there's a unity in that sense, but they weren't like politically united.
But you don't think they had a king like that was able to, they had maybe controlled more area than later on?
Yeah, there was no like a king who controlled the entire area. No.
Yeah.
Greece wouldn't be fully united until Macedon came, and that lasted. Well, no, they weren't even fully united then. Until they wouldn't be relatively united until Macedon.
Yeah, and I guess
because even when Macedon was there, there were still holdouts for a while.
Right.
There's still the Spartans and the Peloponnese who kind of just were left to their own devices. But yeah, that's a
lot. And then these were different Greeks, right? Those Mycenaean Greeks were kind of different than the later Greeks. Is that correct?
It depends who you talk to. This is a tricky question to answer. Like it depends on what sources you look at. They're on the periphery. The Mycenaeans themselves, I mean, they claim descent from the Argives and Heracles. Demosthenes tried to proclaim them as another because they didn't have a polis. They were different. For all intents and purposes, they were part of the Greek world. They weren't like the Greek world in sense like Thessaly and Macedon weren't quite what you think of like a city-state polis type of Greek. But I mean, they spoke Greek. They spoke a form of Greek. They had similar religion and customs. It was slightly different, but for all intents and purposes, they were part of the Greek world, just on the periphery.
And the whole world, right. So they were trading, I think, a lot with the Cretans are obviously had been trading with Egypt for a long time.
Mm-hmm. The Minoans had, I believe, as far back as the Middle Kingdom. It might have been earlier, but I definitely know as early as the Middle Kingdom, the Minoans had penetrated the Delta and traded with the Egyptians.
Right.
Middle Kingdom being like 1800. So we're talking about the second millennium BC.
That's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it's 2000, maybe 2000 BC.
Yeah, probably 2000 BC. Way back there.
Yeah, it's been a while. I might have my dates on the Middle Kingdom wrong, but yeah.
you get a pass on the weird far away dates. Mm-hmm. But there was this really cool, when I was doing the research, I found this about this shipwreck that they found in the Levantine coast from 1305 BC. And mm-hmm. they believe it was carrying a Mycenaean diplomatic mission. And then it did have all the other trade goods from the rest of the Bronze Age culture. So there was copper and tin and, you know.
The Ulubua one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it looks like they think, you know, felt that there were Greeks, you know, Mycenaeans that were on a diplomatic mission. So if they were on a diplomatic mission, then they must have been, you know, in the Near East, they're aware of these people anyway, even if they weren't from a whole United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that's one of the fascinating archaeological discoveries because it goes to show like the extent of the Eastern Central Mediterranean trade network at that time, because there were just goods found from all over the place.
Right.
Egyptian goods, Near Eastern goods, tin, copper from Cyprus, tin as far away from, I think, Spain at that point. The Minoans had a pretty decent trade network too, and the Mycenaeans kind of just, whenever they took over, they kind of commandeered it, so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, and that's part of the whole wrap up into the Bronze Age collapse is like you have this network that's this trade commercial network that kind of is so dependent upon each other that when things start to go bad and some of the societies quote unquote collapse, it brings down the entire net. It brings down everybody.
Right.
Because everybody's so dependent upon the economies of everyone else.
Everybody, right. We lost the writing. Yeah. We lost everything.
And then some of the civilizations were able to weather it. The ones that had more, like the Egyptians, I mean, they went to an intermediate period. And the Assyrians came out and the Phoenicians came out of it relatively strong. And the Phoenicians basically just tapped into that Mycenaean trade network and took over it. And, you know. And then made it their own, and then the Greeks got back, and then the Greeks got when writing came back, and the Greeks kind of after a century or so kind of came back, quote unquote, Dark Ages into the Archaic period or Iron Age period, whatever definition you want to use. It, you know, they kind of tapped into that same network and expanded upon it.
Mm-hmm, yes. So yeah, we see. I mean, they were still connected with them there. I mean, I guess if you went, you know, the Assyrians didn't, in the Iron Age didn't seem like they knew a ton about the Greeks, but I don't know if they were really that interested. Could be the issue.
The Assyrians?
Yeah.
Well,
they called them Yaman, like they called them Ionians. So the Assyrian word, and even today, the these words in the East for Greeks is the word for Ionian. Hmm. They called them Yawan or Yamans, And so, yeah, today, even in Arabic, Turkish, and Persian, the word for Greek is Yunani, which is which is like Ionian.
Yeah, well, the Greeks were, they were pretty far off from where the Assyrian core was. Like, the Assyrians had the Phoenicians under their control. Those were, like, they had access to the Phoenician ports. So the Phoenicians were, like, the middlemen to, like, the Greek trade network. And so they were still plugged into the, they traded with the Greeks, you know. They had Almina in Syria, which was eventually a Syrian territory. The Syrians would trade as far out as Spain, and they would trade. And the Greeks were involved, Carthage later, the Phoenicians, the Greek Sicilians and Marseille, the Etruscans. They were tapped into that trade network. It's just they had, there was really no need to, I don't want to say there was no need, but like they were never a threat of like the Assyrians going to cross into European land and conquer the Greeks.
Right.
They had what they needed in the Phoenicians, access to that trade network.
Right. And that's just good. You brought up Almina. That was that seems to be where the main Greek foothold in the Near East was for a long time, right?
Yeah, I think that was created in about the late 8th, not the 8th, I'm sorry, like the late 9th century. Like,
yeah, like 825 is the
that's what it is.
Something around there that they, it's all, there's no really a lot of, we don't even know what they called it, right? We just know that that's what it's called now.
Mm-hmm. And there also was some contact between the Phoenicians and the Greeks on Cyprus as well. Yeah, the Euboeans came out of the quote unquote Dark Ages relatively faster, and they were one of the big colonizers and traders.
Yes.
Euboeans, Eretrians, and Halkis being the two big city-states on the island of Euboea. And then you also have the Corinthians, and they also big colonizers as well in the west. Halkis, you know, that's why the Halkidiki, they went north and colonized. Halkidiki, named after the city-state of Halkis. And you have other city-states that also had colonies as well. Miletus did a lot of colonizing in the Black Sea. The Athenians, yeah, not so much. The Spartans, not so much. They had a few off and ons, but it seemed to be the Euboeans, Corinth, and Miletus were the big ones, with a few others spread around here or there.
Right.
And those would be the primary traders in the archaic period.
And, I mean, we just, it's just funny how a lot of the big empires still just got, didn't, had them kind of confused, you know, where they didn't realize that there was this whole thing called Greece, you know, because like we say, the Greeks weren't united, but they still had the Olympics every year, every 4 years, I should say. So they were a culture, but it just seems that like the Assyrians, especially because they're the ones who kept the records. There's not one reference to the Greeks in the whole letter archive that they found in Nineveh.
Mostly, I mean, from my understanding, there was most of the interaction came between Greek and Assyria would have came through Egyptian, Lydian. There was a buffer there. It wasn't until a little bit later in the archaic period that the Assyrians really came. I mean, you had when they penetrated Egypt and helped Greek mercenaries helped overthrow the Assyrian yoke with Egypt and established what's the pharaoh's name?
That was Necho.
Yeah, Necho.
Semiticus was the one who Semiticus brought in
and, yeah, or Samtek. However you want to call him.
Oh, yeah, you right. I pronounce him Semiticus.
Well, he is a...
the, I can pronounce.
Yeah. Yeah, until I think that's in like the late 500 or early 500s.
We're right in that period. So okay, it was the 650s when they started. Then the Greeks started moving in when Gyges brought in the... So he brought in the Carians and then with Greeks and into, you know, Egypt to help Semiticus like shore up his... There was 12 other... kinglets stronger than in Egypt that he had actually beat.
I mean, that's when most of the 7th century and the 6th century is where you get a huge flowering of cultural interaction between Greece and the East. You get places at like Miletus that seems to be kind of at this center point between the two, where you get philosophy, you get ideas coming from East and West. You get with Thales and Anaximenes and Anaximander. You get places like Naucratis and Phonis in Egypt that become these trading areas after Egypt reestablishes native rule again. You get Greek mercenaries serving in the armies of Nebuchadnezzar when the Neo-Babylonian come about. We have, we even have mention of that when, like, Alkeus from Lesbos mentions his brother was off serving at Carchemish, I think. I might have the wrong battle, but one of those battles under Nebuchadnezzar.
That's a pretty interesting story, actually.
So you get Greek, you get interaction all throughout the 7th and 6th centuries. The evidence is piecemeal at best earlier than that. And it's still piecemeal when you get later, but it's still obviously there. there's more instances on the historical record, at least Neo-Babylonian, Egyptian, Lydian contact than, say, Assyrian.
That's a good story, actually, too, as I just found out the quote here where it's, he says to his, about his brother, "From the ends of the earth you are come with your sword hilt of ivory, bound with gold. You accomplished a great feat and delivered the Babylonians from distress, for you slew a warrior of 5 royal cubits less a span." Mm-hmm. So that means he was like 2.5 meters. So he's like 8 feet tall.
Mm-hmm. I think it was referring to Carchemish. I also could have that wrong.
Yeah, I think that's the battle. Yeah, I think.
I don't know. You haven't covered the Neo-Babylonians yet, I don't think.
Yeah, no. I found that for this, but then.
So then I'm sure you have your research. Have your research well in advance, though, so you might have come across it while doing research.
I'm sure, yeah.
And that's all you're going to hear from Bernie and Ryan this time, but Ryan will be back next week. So I wanted to tell you guys, you've heard it before, I have 3 favorite podcasts that regards history. It's anything Mike Duncan does, mostly Rome, history of Rome, and then Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, from which the name of this podcast comes, and then Ryan Stitt's The History of Ancient Greece. I just noticed that the numbering of our podcast is almost the same. The latest released episode when I record this of The History of Ancient Greece is episode 105, Carthage Enters the War. And this is episode 106 of Fano History, so we have been going almost as long. But Ryan will be back in 2 weeks for part 2 of this. But while you're waiting for another episode of Fano History, go check out the History of Ancient Greece podcast. Great stuff.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.